This is the Podium Finish Live from Austin, Texas, and various points across the country. Here's your host, Rob Tiansen.
And a good day to everyone out there listening to us. Welcome to the Podium Finish Live, episode number 85. I'm Rob Tiansen, alongside Nathan Solomon. We're so happy you could join us for the world's fastest hour racing talk as we look at the post-Daytona, pre-Darlington edition of a playoff edition of TPF Live. That's right, folks. We are now in the NASCAR Cup Series playoffs. You know what that means. There's 10 more races left in the season. And of course, within those 10 races, we're going to have four distinct rounds that decide who gets to contend for the championship and who is basically just racing for glory and honor for second best. So this is going to be a fun next 10 weeks when we get from episode 85 to episode number 95, when we look ahead to the season finale in Phoenix. But for now, we're thinking about South Carolina and that egg-shaped 1.366-mile Darlington Raceway. The lady in black, too tough to track, too tough to tame, whatever you want to call her, Darlington is what we're going to be thinking about quite a bit on this program. For those of you who are not in the recording session right now with me and Nathan, I have a background of a driver who knows what it takes to win at Darlington because he will be in the hot seat for today. It will be Dale Jarrett, the driver of the number 88 Quality Care Ford Credit Red Carpet Lease Ford ride back in the good old days of 1996 to 2006. Of course, now you know that Dale, who is also the 1999 NASCAR Cup Series champion, three-time Daytona 500 champion, and also, by the way, he almost had a chance to win the Winston Million back in 1996. You guys know that he's also an announcer for NASCAR on NBC, so you see him often, but we're going to actually get to hear from Dale about those good old days and why he is considered one of the 75 greatest drivers in NASCAR history. So I'm excited about this. It's actually an interview from my archives and I'm ready to dust out and treat you fans because it's the 75th anniversary of NASCAR. So what better time to have one of the best in the business talking about their career than right now as we get to Darlington. So before we get Dale on the program, of course, let's go bring in Nathan because that was quite the wild weekend of racing that we had at Daytona and also for the Truck Series with their second race of the round of 10 with what happened at the Milwaukee Mile with all those penalties and Grant Enfinger winning the race, despite the fact that GMS Racing is going to shut their doors down after Phoenix of this season. I mean, so much happened over the weekend, Nathan. So how are you doing, man? And are you ready for some round of 16 action from Darlington?
Yeah, no doubt. Good to be here. Good to be back. I haven't been on since before Watkins Glen, the last race I covered, because I couldn't make it last week with just moving in and everything. But we're back at St. Bonaventure, ready to roll here for my final two semesters, so my senior year. Gearing up for a lot of TV stuff. I've been calling a couple games on ESPN Plus already, some soccer games, got some more. So if you're looking for something on Thursday at 7 p.m., or Friday at 2 p.m., be sure to tune into St. Bonaventure women's and then men's soccer, respectively, and you can listen to yours truly call the game. So that's fun. I highly recommend you do that. Shameless plug. But, it was certainly a wild weekend. I mean, Xfinity always lives up to expectations. The Cup race was really good. Obviously, we had a couple of really scary wrecks, so glad everybody is okay after those. And then you mentioned the Truck Series, too. A lot of penalties up there in Milwaukee, I think four in total, but obviously certainly a significant penalty to Ty Majeski, which, I mean, I guess doesn't mean a whole lot because he's locked into the playoffs and he retained his playoff eligibility, but it's still certainly significant. But ready to break all that down and look ahead to the Cup Series playoff opener this weekend at Darlington, and hopefully everything will go okay. I know the tropical storm or hurricane is kind of headed in that direction, so hopefully it passes through, everybody will be all right, and we can still have a good but safe weekend of racing.
Yes, because it was, as Nathan pointed out, Hurricane Alalia is certainly making her rounds in the southeast. So as of this recording, of course, I believe it's actually making a trajectory towards that area. So for you folks in the southeast, from the Carolinas down to Florida, please keep safe. Adhere to the instructions of your local officials so you don't find yourself in harm's way. Things can get replaced, but lives cannot. So we can't stress it enough, and we hope everybody in that area will be okay. As far as the race is concerned, it looks like that's going to be clearing out. We'll have some good racing. Good old classic, hot, humid Darlington. I mean, that's just typically how it goes. But it should be a good race. And we'll have our Texas photographer, Dylan Nadwadny, doing the first of his two races in the month of September, kicking things off at Darlington rather. So it'll be good to have him around. And before we get to Podium Perspectives, which of course is the main meat and potatoes where Nathan and I talk, they want to give some condolences, of course, to Wayne Regal on the loss of his dog, Mojo. I know it's tough to lose a furry friend, and I've been there before, and certainly hope Wayne will be okay, keeping our thoughts and prayers with him. And of course, to our buddy, Dylan Nadwadny as well, because he also lost his best friend, you know, his puppy that he's had for the last 6 years. And it's always tough to see someone lose their friend. So for Teddy and Mojo, this show is dedicated to both of you guys up in the good old Rainbow Bridge, wherever you are. And keep your masters in mind. I hope you guys serve as guardian angels over your friends that are here on Earth still. And it's going to be a good weekend because we've also got the action at the NHRA level, of course, because we've got a triple threat for the Dodge Broker Power Brokers U.S. Nationals at the Lucas Oil Indianapolis Raceway Park. For those of you not well-versed with drag racing, let's just say that this is their Indianapolis 500. It's like their Daytona 500 this Labor Day weekend. So much to look forward to. If you love the quarter mile stuff with fast cars and great personalities. So looking forward to seeing us cover that event. And also, as if that's not enough, Luis Torres is going to be at Portland for the BitNile.com Portland Grand Prix, the penultimate race of the IndyCar series, in which Alex Palou looks to close out and get his second championship. But his teammate from Chip Ganassi, Scott Dixon, is looking for a seventh championship, and it's not mathematically out of the question with the way that Scott's won the last two races in a row. So anything can and may be possible in the open wheel circuit. So stay tuned to the Podium Finish. We've got a lot on our plates, lots to look forward to. But as you listen to our show, why don't we introduce our sponsor and our partner, SpoilerDiecast.com. Hey, racing fans. Are you in the hunt for the latest diecast cars from Lionel Racing or F1 or IndyCar diecasts? Well, look no further. If you head to SpoilerDiecast.com, you'll find all of the latest and greatest diecast cars and get free shipping and 5% off of your orders if you use promo code TPF by spending $20 or more on your items. Head over to SpoilerDiecast.com and let Evan and his team know that you want the best diecast cars around. And if you use promo code TPF, you'll be in the winner's circle. It doesn't get better than that. So just head on over to SpoilerDiecast.com and make your latest purchases today. Get to it on SpoilerDiecast.com, folks. Promo code TPF will get you free shipping and 5% off of your orders of $20 or more. Get to it because there's a lot of merchandise that's arriving pretty much every other week, sometimes every week, with those containers arriving from China for Lionel Racing and Greenlight Collectibles. So get to it, folks. Don't regret making those purchases because you're going to save some money and headaches and get free shipping with promo code TPF. Why don't we kick things off now with Podium Perspectives powered by Spoiler Diecast. It's going to be an exciting playoffs on the Cup Series side of things because unlike past years where we've pretty much had different race winners, but all from relatively the same teams, this season we've got a lot of parity as far as the 16 driver and team field. Just strictly talking about the Drivers' Championship playoff race, we have 10 different organizations that are going to be going for this year's Cup Championship. Just imagine that, folks. That's quite a lot of teams in the NASCAR Cup Series, ranging from the usual suspects like Hendrick Motorsports and Joe Gibbs to emerging teams like Trackhouse Racing and RFK Racing. And then you've got those teams that really are like, wow, it's just we're even happy to even make it this far. like Front Row Motorsports, making their ascent into the 16 driver round of 16 playoff segment, kicking off this weekend, of course, with the Cookout Southern 500 at Darlington. Nathan, in your opinion, is this the best diverse field that we've had yet in the basically 20 years of a playoff format in Cup?
I mean, certainly one of them. I mean, last year we had, I guess, essentially 16 winners. I mean, of only 15 of the 16 ended up making it because of the Kurt Busch injury, which is obviously unfortunate. But so I'd say one of those two. Obviously, we had a couple more guys point their way in this year. So we had 13 winners. Well, 14 winners, including SVG, but 13 points earning winners, and then three guys that pointed their way into the playoffs. Or was it 12 and 4? No. 13-3, I think. My mind slipped there for a second. But 13-3, I talked myself out of it. I think so. I mean, obviously, you look at a team like Front Row, they've certainly made a lot of gains this year. I mean, Michael McDowell's team has consistently run up front. They've been quick. I mean, they've been particularly quick on road courses, but they've certainly been no slouches on a lot of the intermediate stuff either. I mean, they've had speed to at least compete. And I look at a team like that to be a surprise to get maybe not even just into the round of 12 and don't fall over here, but I think honestly they could make the round of 8. Like I don't think it's completely far-fetched. I think this round is tougher for a team like McDowell's than the round of 12, because you look at the round of 12 tracks, it's Texas, which, okay, that's an intermediate. Then you got Talladega, a super speedway where McDowell's great at, and then a road course in the Roval where McDowell's really good at. So if he can survive the round of 16, he could go on a run. Bubba Wallace, I mean, maybe the results haven't always been there. I mean, but they've consistently been running top 15, but a lot of the reason why they maybe haven't been top 10 is because they've been points racing. So he's another guy I look at as somebody who could, I guess, certainly make a deep run. Going up the standings a little bit more, I think people are sleeping on Chris Buescher, even though he's won 3 of the last 5 races. I mean, I think he's seeded like 5th to start the playoffs or something. I mean, he's got like 20 something playoff points, so he has a little bit of a cushion there. With the way they're running, he's certainly a sleeper. But and then kind of on the other side of things, I mean, I guess I'm kind of just going with who I like and who I don't like right now. A couple of the guys that I'm certainly worried about, I'll give you 3. Tyler Reddick, you know, that team's really struggled with execution throughout the whole year. I don't know if that's going to change in the playoffs, and if that's the case, they could maybe be an early exit. And then Ross Chastain and Kyle Busch, the speed has been way off for those guys throughout the summer. You know, Ross Chastain, he won Nashville, but really since Darlington in early May, when obviously he was under a lot of controversy for that move with Kyle Larson, the speed has not been there for the one team. They've been maybe 10th, 15th at best. And then Kyle Busch, the last 6 to 8 weeks, they've been pretty far off, except for Richmond, where I think they finished 3rd. Short tracks, they've really struggled on throughout the year. You got one to end the round of 16 at Bristol. So I'm a little concerned about those last 3, but you know, the 3 guys I mentioned right there, to start at least, you look at McDowell, you look at Wallace, you look at Buescher, those are some of your sleepers. Of course, in addition to, I think a lot of people might have their 4 favorites and everybody else, and for a lot of people, it's probably the same. And it's the Hendrick duo of Kyle Larson and William Byron, and the JGR duo of Denny Hamlin and Martin Truex Jr.
Those are some great thoughts and perspectives, and actually that's kind of my championship 4 as we speak. But as we've learned last year, anything can happen.
Me too.
Anything can happen to those guys, because I had championship 4 predictions with Kyle Larson, and goodness gracious, the round of 12 could not have gone any worse for him, even though it kicked off pretty decently at Texas last year. But yeah, I think that's the way I see things going too, folks, because yes, we have a lot of great upstarts, lots of these sort of dark horse drivers and teams, but you ultimately have to know that the cream of the crop is likely to rise to the championship 4 and have a desert duel for the greatest prize in NASCAR Cup Series racing, aside from the Daytona 500, of course, the Cup trophy, which is going to be pretty hard to carry and hoist after a 3.5-hour race in Avondale, Arizona. So stay tuned for all of those great storylines here on TPF, because we're certainly going to be at as many or at all of these 10 races. So we're looking forward to capturing all the action and writing down exactly what goes on. So you read it, folks, who says that there isn't any impartial NASCAR outlets. Don't dismiss us. We're pretty darn good at what we do. Moving on now to topic number two for Podium Perspectives. This one's kind of a surprise, but yet not really a surprise, folks, because Carson Hocevar is obviously a driver whose stock is literally rising. He's only 20 years old, and the Portage, Michigan driver has really shown that when he is not, you know, distracted, he's got his head on straight, his, you know, all those screws are tightened. Man, that kid is a great driver. I mean, he's in the midst of a truck championship playoff hunt with the weekend off, and then they'll resume the round of 10 at Kansas. But I thought he did a heck of a job being an emergency driver for the number 7 team with all that happened at Charlotte for Gateway. He did a good job in Corey LaJoie's car until the brake failure situation in turn one. And now he's going to get another chance to be in a cup car, arguably, I think, in a better cup car, despite the fact that Legacy Motor Club may be in a lame duck situation with Chevrolet. He'll be in the number 42 car, the Sunseeker Resorts Chevrolet Camaro, this weekend. We know that given the right driver and, you know, everything going well with practice and qualifying, this 42 car does have a bit of speed. Maybe not the top speed, but I think Carson Hocevar can get himself a nice top 15 finish. So that's my prediction on that. Nathan, what do you see out of this kid from Michigan? Do you think he'll do a good job?
Well, and what you mentioned earlier, I mean, the screws seem to finally kind of tightened a little bit this year. He's been racing a lot smarter. You know, I know if he's kind of talked a little bit about almost like a little bit of a come to Jesus moment with Dale Jr. when he first kind of stepped in the JRM shop to run the Spire car for the first time, because their alliance is on the Xfinity side. But yeah, he's done a really good job this year. I mean, I think everybody knew that once he got to victory lane in the truck series, the wins would keep coming, and they certainly have. And when he's not winning, most of the time he's running like fourth or fifth. Like he's in the mix every week. He's certainly one of the favorites right now to win the championship. And honestly, I'd probably put him number two behind Corey Heim right now, just because that 38 truck of Zane Smith's been kind of off this year, and I don't really know why. But yeah, I mean, he deserves the opportunities. I mean, in the handful of starts he's done with Spire, he's run well. He hasn't won a race, but he's regularly been top six, top eight, which is really impressive for his first couple Xfinity starts. Obviously, did the cup race for Spire this year, and the Corey LaJoie, Chase Elliott situation from, you know, when Chase wrecked Denny at Charlotte. But now we don't really know how long Carson's going to be in the 42. And like you mentioned, just kind of an awkward situation there. Obviously, we talked about what happened with Noah. Legacy, obviously, going to Toyota next year. It's just a weird situation that they have to find a way to fill that car for the next 10 weeks. So interested to see how much more time Carson gets in that car. There's obviously, you know, the rumor mill's churning about where Carson could end up next year. I'm not really going to go into that a whole lot, but there's certainly rumors of where he could be, and it could potentially be in either of the three series. So, it's certainly valuable experience for him, and no matter when it will be, I think down the road, he's certainly a full-time cup driver. So, we've seen in the past, hey, Legacy's pretty good at Darlington. They obviously won this race last year with Eric Jones, so I expect that car to be at least be competitive.
For sure. I mean, top 15, top 10, maybe in the mix for the victory, because this is a track where you don't exactly have to be super fast for the first 300 laps. What happens in the final 100 miles is what really matters, from basically lap 301 to at least 367. So we know that Eric Jones is great with tire management, and I think Carson Hocevar is actually going to go to school and learn quite a lot from Jones and the Cup Series, and being in a car that I think will be a little bit more on level with his talent, and knowing that he has certainly harnessed his aggression at the right times, picking his battles a lot better. And this is a great track for him to go and get his second Cup start, because if he can have a good, respectable run, he's probably going to get into the wall at some point. Everyone does. But, you know, just basically learn this racetrack, race the racetrack, and then you can race the competition. I think he can get himself a respectable result, and that's going to give him some confidence when he gets into his 42 truck on next Friday night at Kansas. He jokingly said on social media, well, at least I'm going to be going to a pit stall with number 42 pit stall sign. So I thought that was pretty funny. So hopefully he doesn't make that mistake on pit road at Darlington. Speaking of pit stops, Let's talk about the Team Penske crew switch, because earlier this week, it was announced that Team Penske will do a bit of a crew chief swap where Brian Wilson, who was the crew chief for Harrison Burton's affiliate team with Wood Brothers Racing, the number 21 team, of course, he'll be heading over to Austin Cindric's number 2 car, in which Jeremy Bolins will be the crew chief for Harrison Burton. Both teams kind of need a bit of a shot in the arm, because admittedly, the number 2 team has just, it's been unusual. I can't explain what's happened over with that organization's, I would say their fleet, their marquee car, because let's face it, it's like the Yankees having that famous number that hasn't retired, and that jersey number not doing so well. Well, the number 2 car having a bad season is just not something that you often say out loud or write in an article. Meanwhile, for Harrison Burton, it's admittedly been a struggle for him this year, despite the fact he's had some good runs at places like Pocono and, of course, earlier this year at Darlington. But sophomore season's been pretty tough for Mr. Burton. So, Nathan, what do you think of this move at this point? I mean, do you think there's nothing to lose for these two teams that really just need to have something good happen before this year closes out?
Yeah, and I'll go back a year, or even to the end of the 2021 season. I mean, Harrison Burton and Austin Cindric both went to Cup at the same time. And who did Austin Cindric work with in the Xfinity Series and win an Xfinity Series championship with? Well, that'd be Brian Wilson. I thought this as soon as they both went up to Cup at the same time. Like, why not put those two together? They obviously have, you know, some sort of camaraderie. They've ran well together in the past. Why not put them together? And obviously, Cindric won the 500 last year and made the playoffs. But so I thought that right away. But now they're back together. So I think that can maybe give that two team a little spark. The 21 team's been up and down a little bit this year, but maybe they can find that consistency now with a veteran crew chief like Jeremy Bolins. But no doubt, Ford is still at a little bit of a disadvantage. Team Penske in particular, they've struggled across the board. I mean, Joey Logano's only win came at Atlanta, a drafting track. I mean, they hit it with Ryan Blaney at Charlotte, and he ran really well and won, obviously. But that team's just not been good this year. I mean, there's no way around it. I mean, neither of those two Penske cars are certainly my favorites in the playoffs by any means, but they've got work to do. I mean, it certainly feels like they're the number 3 Ford team right now out of 4, and that's putting RFK at 1 and Front Row at 2, which, I mean, you'd always think it'd be kind of the other way around. You'd put Team Penske and Stuart Haas above those two, but right now I'd put the only Ford team I'd really put them above, except for, like, well, I mean, Rick Ware, of course, but I'd put I don't really put them above Stuart Haas Racing in terms of your threats. So maybe that can kind of kickstart those other two cars while the other two cars try to find a way to make their way on a deep playoff run.
Yeah, I mean, who, like you said, Nathan, whoever thought that you would say Team Penske is second to last team in the Ford totem pole as far as quality of the season, because Front Row Motorsports is overachieving. And RFK Racing has really just lit up the stock car world with how great Chris Busch is running and how Brad Keselowski is this close, folks, to finally snapping that 2-year winless streak. I mean, it's incredible just how off Team Penske's been as far as pace and just having competitive runs. So I think at this point, you might as well have you know, Brian Wilson back with his former driver in Austin Cindric, because we know, folks, we've seen in at least the Truck Series, or Xfinity Series rather, when Marty Lindley was paired up with Sam Mayer for this season, what's been going on with that team? Number one team has been incredible. They've got 2 victories. You've got a driver who's super confident and a crew chief who may be in his first season with this team, but he sure looks like somebody who's been around in that garage area for Xfinity for quite a long time. So not saying that all of a sudden Austin Cindric's going to win 2 races, but I certainly think it's a great, great move for Brian Wilson. And as far as you folks who may not like Jeremy Bolins, hey, look, this is the guy who got Brad Keselowski to be in the championship 4 in 2020. I know that was a COVID season, but y'all were dissing on Jeremy Bolins. And guess what? He got Brad Keselowski so close to winning his second championship. And we may be talking about 2-time champion Brad Keselowski and Chase Elliott still searching for his first championship. So when Jeremy Bolins is with the right situation and he's, you know, got a driver who he can communicate well with, I'm telling you, I think things could go a little bit better for the 21 team. And I know Harrison Burton is doing everything he can. We talked to him. This kid knows the mechanical nuances of these cars. I think it's just a matter of getting with a crew chief who can understand those same mechanical nuances so that they can tailor their car to his liking and eventually get the pace to be a contender within the top 15 and eventually the top 10, much more often than not. So we'll see what happens. Again, stay tuned to the podium finish on those stories because I'm certainly going to be watching what happens at least to the 21 team in these next 10 weeks. Now, ladies and gentlemen, you know what time it is on Podium Perspectives and TPF Live. That's right, it's winning time. And this is the time where Nathan and I provide our picks for the NASCAR races. So, of course, chronologically speaking, we'll talk about the NASCAR Xfinity Series, Sport Clips, Haircuts, VFW, Help a Hero 200, in which the defending winner is Noah Gragson. But of course, he's not racing in this event and he's still suspended by NASCAR indefinitely. So we'll have a different winner for this race at 3:30 on USA on Saturday. And then, of course, at 6 p.m. East Coast time on USA on Sunday night, you can expect to watch the Cookout Southern 500, the NASCAR Cup Series playoff opener and around the 16 opener, in which Erik Jones hopes to get his first win in almost a calendar year. So let's hear from Nathan first, and then we'll hear my picks.
Yeah, so I'm going to keep my picks simple for this weekend, and it's the same pick for both races. I'm going with the Denny Hamlin sweep. Denny Hamlin is back in the Xfinity Series on Saturday. He's in the 19 car for Joe Gibbs Racing, basically his one Xfinity race a year. If I remember correctly, I think he was supposed to do this race last year, but ended up stepping out of the race because he had something uncomfortable in his back or neck or something. But he's back, so I think his first Xfinity start since probably this race in 2021. And Darlington's his best track. He has, I believe, at least two Southern 500s. So I feel like he's always either in the mix for the Xfinity race as well or wins the Xfinity race. So that team's been, I think, quietly having an outstanding summer. I mean, they only have the Pocono win to show for it, at least in the summer months, but they are in the mix every single week. And since this is Denny, one of Denny's best tracks, I think we'll go with a Denny Hamlin sweep here this weekend.
That's pretty straightforward. There's no like having to critically think about who would be different, of course. I like the philosophy of going with a sweep. I'm going to, of course, go a different direction with my sweep pick. I'm going to say Kyle Larson, who is his best friend off the track, on the track. I don't know if they're good buddies or not, but I think Kyle Larson's more than capable of winning the Xfinity race on Saturday. If you saw what happened earlier this year, when he was driving the number 10 Kolle entry, despite when he fell back from basically the end of the field, and then he found his way towards the front and had that great battle with John Hunter Nemechek. I'm not so sure if Nemechek's going to be just as easy to pass this time, but if Larson's car is super fast and he's managed his tires, I think he'll get Saturday's victory pretty well. It's the Cup race that I think will be interesting to see because the number five car has really. I don't know. I don't want to say they've lost pace necessarily, but they're not exactly as fast as they were in the springtime. And that was been a bit of a concern with Larson after Daytona. But this is the playoffs. We all know what Hendrick Motorsports does once the regular season ends. The experimentations are over. We're going to get to the tried and true setups that get that car to be as good as possible. So we'll see what happens in practice and qualifying on Saturday afternoon. But if they can get towards the front of the field and they have good pace and Larson stays out of trouble, I think he'll do better than 13th, which is what he did last year. I'm pretty confident he'll get the victory on Sunday night, get win number three, and breathe a little bit easier until he gets to Texas for the round of 12. So those are our picks. That's Podium Perspectives for this week, folks. But let us know what you think. You can get with us on social medias, which includes X and Threads, because now Threads is available on the web. So we should be able to respond to you a lot faster, folks. Nathan's handle is nsolly02. I'm at Rob Tionkson. And of course, our general social media account is at the Podium Finish. Get with us. If you make the right picks, you'll get yourself a 2023 in stock diecast car, 164 scale, of course, from spoilerdiecast.com, our presenting sponsor. So before we get to the last segment, of course, just want to say a big shout out to our team at Daytona, Cornell Chu and Christopher Vargas on a job well done. Awesome job doing the coverage at Daytona. We really loved it. And Mike Moore and Teresa Bennick, for a spectacular job in the Milwaukee Mile. Your efforts are not for dismissed. It's appreciated, and we love everything that we saw. And yes, folks, I do want to address something that was said on social media. Yes, it's true, unfortunately, that Kobe Lambeth is departing the podium finish after the season, but we've had a great 5.5 year run, almost 6 years with Kobe. As you know, Kobe's had a lot of great things happening to him, and you know, he's going to step back, figure out the next game plan for him, but we support him. He will always be a friend to us. We look forward to working with him these last 10 weeks in his tenure at TPF, and he will not be a stranger to the Podium Finish family. So thank you, Kobe, for everything you've done over the years. And I know our fans of TPF Nation love what you've done over the years with all the coverage you've done. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Now with that, folks, why don't we mosey on over to the hot seat? Now, this hot seat's a bit of an archived interview because I've been waiting to get this out here, really, at the right time. And what better time is there than NASCAR's 75th anniversary season? So this interview took place during the midst of COVID, so I've had to edit it for clarity, of course, and just get rid of some of the irrelevant points. But otherwise, this is a really great in-depth interview with one of the greatest drivers in NASCAR history. He's a 1999 NASCAR Cup Series champion. He is also a three-time champion of the Daytona 500. He's won at Darlington with the spring race. He knows what it takes to win crown jewel events and million-dollar bonuses. And of course, he is always associated with the Ford Performance Camp, especially with Robert Yates Racing and Wood Brothers. So sit back, relax, as we get to know a member of the 2014 class of the NASCAR Hall of Fame, Dale Jarrett.
Dale, while most fans recall your years with the number 88 Robert Yates Racing Team, I feel that most don't really recall your tenure with the Wood Brothers Racing Team, particularly in 1991, which I view as a seminal season for you. So first of all, how was it like to drive for this team and know that, you know, after all you've been through up until 1991, heading into that year, that was your ride?
Yeah, that was, as I look back on my career, you know, we all have defining moments, and whether that's a year, and a certain event, whatever it may be, but my tenure with the Wood Brothers, which started in the 1990 season, I actually was out of the Cup Series, running my own, Busch Grand National team at the time. And, early in the season, Neil Bonnett, who was driving for the Wood Brothers, was injured. I got a concussion, literally right at the end of the Darlington spring race. And so the Wood Brothers were a family that I had known my entire life. I'd been around them. And, when Eddie Wood called me about replacing Neil Bonnett, the next race was Bristol in 1990. And so I didn't know if that's going to be one race, might be two, might be five, didn't know. As it turns out, I drove the rest of 1990, went into 91 as the driver of the Citgo Ford, for the Wood Brothers. It was a dream come true. Little did I know that this would be the turning point of my racing career. I owe a lot to a lot of people, but without that opportunity from the Wood Brothers to drive their car and eventually then in 1991 get my first win in the Cup Series driving for the Wood Brothers, that changed my life, my professional life forever. And without that, I don't know what of the rest of it may have would have happened. And so it was that opportunity that I got from the Wood Brothers, and in particular that full season in 1991 of being able to drive for them, was the turning point and the thing that changed my career on a very upward path after that.
Absolutely. And the thing that really inspires me is that you kept working at it. And despite coming from a very famous racing family, it seemed like to me that you really wanted to earn this on your own, and, you know, you wanted to make this opportunity happen. And given the fact that, you know, I'm about the same age as you when you got this opportunity with the Wood Brothers team, you know, speaking from my own journey as a writer, it's been tough, but, you know, I finally feel like I'm finding my stride. So, you know, when you consider, you know, you found this home and you've got that first win, you know, obviously 1991, a lot of things were heading in the right direction prior to Michigan. So, I mean, prior to that race week, did you feel like you and your team were ready to win despite the ups and downs that were going on during that year?
You know, that's an interesting question, because I don't know that we felt like we were ready to win. But what we were ready for was something that changed for us. We had worked extremely hard on the cars, making them handle better, making them drive better. But we knew that Robert Yates had designed a new cylinder head for Ford, and they were using that. And we were down on horsepower quite a bit. Most of the rest of the Fords were too. There were a couple that were starting to get sets of these cylinder heads, but we were a little bit down the line, even though the Wood Brothers have always been Ford Motor Company. But that day in Michigan in August of 1991 was the first time that we had those cylinder heads. And what I knew was it was going to allow me to compete at a higher level on a more regular basis. And so then from that point, then you just hope that you find yourself in a position to capitalize on that, not having any idea that it might be that very first race that we were using these new cylinder heads. And as things would have it, those cylinder heads that were designed and built by Robert Yates, I was battling his driver at the time, Davey Allison, for the win at the end. Davey had dominated the race. But I had run well all day, and Eddie Wood made a call on our last pit stop, as I was coming down pit road. It was the best my car had been all day long. And he said, let's take a chance and just put gas in and leave these tires on and get track position right up front. And as he did that, then I ended up with the lead, on the exit, of pit road. And so I was in charge of the restart there. Late in the race, and to say everything that transpired from that point forward, I really didn't think I could hold Davey off, but somehow, some way, we were able to do just enough. I mean, I think we won by like 8 inches. The last two laps, Davey and I ran side by side, but for it to come down to that car, whose owner had built these cylinder heads, and to win against Davey Allison, someone that I grew up around the sport with and admired as a driver and a person. It couldn't have been a more fitting ending and way to get my first win in the Cup Series. I had done things my way for a long time. I didn't. People wanted to make comparisons, and always did, about my career versus my dad, but that wasn't what it was about, you know, just making my mark and being the best driver that I could be. I love to compete, and this gave me that opportunity. And to do that and get my first win with the Wood Brothers, as a number of other drivers have, means the world to me.
You know, that's incredible to know that, because I never knew that about the 21 car at the time. I mean, I knew that you were a talented driver, and knew that the 21 team had what it took to contend, but that's pretty neat to know that background for sure, just because when I watched that race, even to this day, it sent chills up my spine, especially those last 10, 15 laps with you and Davey just playing cat and mouse and then having that side-by-side finish. Background story very quickly. That was the very first race I ever watched in my entire life, and it was the happiest accident of my life, because we were channel surfing and looking for something to watch at home. And the NASCAR race was the very first thing I asked my dad to stop the TV on. So he put it on. We watched you win the race. And then the week later, we went to the toy store. My mom bought me your diecast car. And I was so excited. I took it out of the box, but I accidentally scratched my dad's new Oldsmobile Cutlass Sierra. And my dad was very livid, but it's a funny story now because it got us closer, a little happy accident. So I have you to blame, not only for me to be coming to the NASCAR, but for my dad and I had to have a funny story 30-something years later.
Wow, how about that? Yeah, so many interesting things that happened, huh?
It has, in my house, I can safely say you've been one of the big drivers we talk about, especially when I got into NASCAR. I obviously grew up a fan of yours, but I grew up a fan of Jeff Gordon, so we always made friendly race picks, and my mom and dad would always say, Dale's going to win, he's going to beat Jeff, and I'm like, oh, just you wait. So, little background story. I thought I'd share that before I forget. But let me get back to the interview. I'm so sorry. I'm just so excited to talk to you. One of the things I thought was neat about that win, in addition to, who you battled, your journey, the fact your dad called that race with ESPN. I know that he was part of the ESPN team with Ned and Bob, Dr. Jerry Punch and John Kernan. And I can still remember this. I'm not cheating, I promise. And I thought that was so neat that your dad got to be there. I mean, I don't know what it's like to be a parent, but to see your own son win and do something that he loved to do, had that high moment. I couldn't imagine how awesome that was for him and for you. So, how emotional and how special was it to share that moment with him, knowing that you won in front of him?
Yeah, so many people forget that he was calling that race, and because of what happened 2 years later in the 93 Daytona 500, whenever he was calling that race, and of course is winning the Daytona 500, and I'm battling Dale Earnhardt, everybody remembers that and wants to talk about that, but they forget that he was actually in the booth calling the race that I won for my first Cup win in Michigan that day. So, but the thrill of doing that with my dad there, those are things that you can't repay. We can't repay our parents in a lot of ways for all the stuff that they've done for us. And but this was something that I felt like that, he could be proud that, I had followed in his footsteps, not necessarily for that reason, but, just to, I did it because I love to compete, and it was something I wanted to do. And so it was a huge moment to do that. And even though it wasn't one where, like the Daytona 500 in 93, where they just kind of let him talk and call the last lap, I think he was a little bit in shock. He said he couldn't believe that I was still side-by-side with Davey because I almost spun out coming out of turn two. And it was a huge thrill for us to have that family moment, and something that, we'll always have as a father and a son.
Oh, for sure. I think the funny moment I can recall is when they replayed the finish, and then, they teased your dad and said, did you think your son's going to lose in that replay too? So I still remember that moment. One of the cool things about the 91 season that I can recall is that, races started to get on TV more frequently. I grew up in Boston, so, I didn't have cable all the time, but when I did have it, that September of 91, I saw that I could watch you and your competitors on CBS, ABC, ESPN, TBS, and then newcomer TNN. So how huge was it for you to see the NASCAR grow in popularity with the cast of characters it had in that time period?
Yeah, there were so many storylines as you left the 80s and into the early 90s and then all through the 90s. Just incredible to be a part of the sport at a time that I feel like and still feel like to this day, as much as I love the sport today and the things that go on, that time that I was able to spend there with the people that were still there, Richard Petty, when I started, Richard Petty was still there and running and involved. And, this is somebody that I grew up as a kid, watching, staying at the same motels, as my dad whenever they were racing together. And then you had, obviously Dale Earnhardt and Cal Yarbrough and Darrell Waltrip and Rusty Wallace was into his prime at that time. just so many talented drivers. Then you had young drivers like Ernie Irvin and Davey Allison, Kyle Petty. It was just incredible, the names that were there and the popularity of the sport. And it was like every year, it just continued to grow. We'd see more fans at the track. And as you mentioned, with all the different TV coverage that we were starting to get, there were just becoming more and more race fans out there. And it was just an incredible time, to be a part of the sport. I know that a lot of people feel like they came along at the best time, but, there's no doubt in my mind that I came along at the best time of the sport and was able to really enjoy that.
Oh, for sure. I mean, and then not just the cast of characters on the racetrack, the people who call the races. I mentioned your dad already, and of course the ESPN folks, but you had Ken Squire, who was my broadcasting idol. You had Buddy Baker, who was so animated, whether it's verbally or if you watch him on camera, he's always moving his hands, and I thought that was so cool. There's just so many people. When I watch that time period, it brings me back to being 5 years old again. So it's so cool to hear that. You bring up some of the drivers, but I got to ask, who were some of your close on-track friends from 1991, and do you still keep in touch with them to this day?
Yeah, I would say that two of my closest friends during that time were Kyle Petty and Michael Waltrip. Kyle was someone that I grew up around the sport with, and as, life would have it, here we are, both of us working for NBC and working together on the pre-race and post-race show. So it's just incredible. I went on the last year and a half of my career to drive for Michael Waltrip, and Michael is still a good friend to this day. It was fun to help him, start up his team and get things going there with Toyota. Ernie Irvin is someone that I still stay in touch with, and admired and went on to become a teammate, with him at Robert Yates Racing, in the 96 and 97 seasons. Those were people. Sterling Marlin was another one. These were a lot of the guys that their dads too, grew up around the sport or were in the sport. And so I try to stay in touch with, as many of them as I can, but obviously, Michael being around the track and Kyle working with him all the time, those are the ones that I stay in touch with the most.
And those are amazing individuals right there that, certainly have contributed in their own way in NASCAR. You mentioned Ernie Irvin, who is another person that I also liked and looked up to. Now, it's funny, I read somewhere that in the 1995 preseason that you were obviously testing at Daytona. Is it true? Don't want to get you in trouble. Is it true that he snuck in and drove the 28 car while you were somewhere else?
we kind of pulled a fast one there. Yeah, we told the story not long ago. Yeah, for the first time really telling the story and letting people know that we actually did this. It was at for a tribute for Robert Yates back earlier this year. And Ernie had been injured. And that's why I was even at Robert Yates Racing, was to take his place, as he recovered from those injuries. But he felt like that he, he was recovering enough that he wanted to get behind the wheel. So we literally, went into the Robert Yates truck, the hauler, and I went in there and he came back out, with helmet on and everything. And I just stayed inside the hauler. And everybody thought, nobody was really paying any attention because we were up towards the front of what was the old Daytona garage at that time. And so I just stayed out of sight, and he went out and made some laps, and nobody ever knew any difference other than the people that we had there at Robert Yates Racing, and none of us ever said anything. And it was funny, as we were telling this story as it came out back in January, in Concord, Mike Helton happened to be sitting there, and Mike didn't even know it. It was funny to see his reaction. And I think he went on to say that he had heard something about it, but that he just kind of passed it off that, they didn't do that and that didn't happen. But it actually did. So it was fun to help Ernie. Yeah, he was in such a place because in 1990 when he was driving there, he was at such a, in 94, when he had his accident in Michigan, he was leading the points and looking like that he might win the championship and so many things going his way. Then he blew a tire in practice at Michigan and almost ended his life. But he just wanted, he just needed that verification to get back in the car a little bit without having to wait as long as they wanted him to. So yeah, it was pretty cool to be a part of that.
Oh my goodness. That is so cool to know that he did do that. I mean, I can kind of see how y'all pass it off because of the mustaches and the hair. So,
I'm a good bit taller, but like I say, where our truck was, he could kind of sneak up there, and so we were able to pull it off.
That is so awesome. That is so cool to hear. Now, let's talk about that look. You had the cool mustache, and you had the hair in 1991, even at that time. I know it's 91. I know that's the look, and I always hear that from my parents, who are, the same age as you. They would say, that's the look, Rob, that's how it was. But when you look at your photos from that time period and watch the replays of those races, do you sometimes get a good smile and laugh when you think about those memories, not only just with the team, but just your appearance at that time?
Oh, yeah, for sure, yeah. But you know, the longer hair was something that I generally did. I wore that in high school. And I started growing a mustache when I was in high school, and I literally never shaved that mustache off until the year 2000. That when I look back on that, it's easy for me to distinguish a lot of times between, what year something is, especially if you're wearing the same uniforms and had same sponsors. But I look back at it. My kids laugh at it some. My youngest son, Zach, he'll grow a mustache every once in a while and say that he could challenge me for having that mustache. But I said, look, that mustache then, you had a lot of people, Dale Earnhardt had one and a number of others drivers that Kyle Petty had one. So, I wasn't the only one by any means, but it is kind of funny to look back that's what we knew then. And, I'm sure there are plenty of people today that, look at that and think, what the heck was he thinking? But, that was my style at the time.
I call it the Tom Selleck look. So if anyone gives you disrespect for that, I will defend you to the court. My mom, she won't admit it, but I think part of why she liked you is because of your nice looks back there in that time and still today. So I tease her about having a crush on you after all these years. I will for sure. Father's Day is around the corner, and I know it's kind of part of the interview and part of this month as well. Father's Day is definitely a special holiday for all of the sons with our dads, but I've always wanted to ask you, what has been the most helpful or insightful advice that you got from your dad?
I say this the same that to everyone that ever asked me. We certainly talked racing a lot. He taught me a lot about business along the way and helping me as I started my racing career about working on the car. I had to get to know the cars and work on them. So there were a lot of things that advice that he gave me along the way. But the best advice that he gave me, and this came early on, when I was competing in football, basketball, baseball, and golf in high school. But it was treat others the way that you want to be treated. And I felt that always applied no matter what I was doing, whether I was driving a race car, whether I was on the golf course, whether you're at a function of a multi-million dollar company, if you're in the boardroom with them, that holds true no matter what you're doing. And so that has been the best advice my dad ever gave me. And, speaking of Father's Day, we all look for someone that we can look up to. And I know that many have to look outside of their home to find those heroes that they look to. And I certainly had my sports heroes that I looked at and admired. But my all-time hero was at my house every single day as I grew up, and that was my dad. and that never changed and hasn't changed to this day. And I'm 63 and he's 87, and he's still my hero.
That is so touching to hear, and I feel the same way about my dad. My dad and I have a big age difference, unfortunately, but as I've gotten older, I feel like I can relate more to him, and I think a lot of the lessons he's told me as a kid, it resonates to me, and it's kind of special I talk about my dad today, being that it is his birthday. He's 75 today, so yeah, I told him earlier today, I was going to say, it's such a milestone for, you know, to get to that age and still be healthy, because he still drives me crazy, but I still, you know, of course, love my dad because, you know, that's what dads do to their sons. And I'm sure when I have my own kids one day, they'll do the same to me. But, that's true. I mean, I'd say I'm talking to one of my heroes right now, but, you know, each day of my life since 1985, my dad's been my hero too. So yeah, I totally understand that.
Yeah. Good to hear.
Now, I've asked Mark Martin this when I first talked to him last month, but of course, during 1991, the TV booth would sometimes contact you for an in-race interview. So I know that it gave you exposure to the fans to show a personality or at least let them know what it's like to be in your workspace. But I have to ask, was it a situation where you're like, this is cool, you know, I realize I am doing this to let people know what's on my mind? Or did you sometimes go, I mean, you know, I get it, but can we really talk later? I really need to focus on my tachometer and all that.
No, I looked at it as an opportunity to help the sport grow and to bring fans closer to the action. And I felt like that this was a very unique opportunity that NASCAR drivers have in that, you know, there's nowhere else at any other sport at any level that while you're competing, yeah, obviously it was under caution or as the race was getting ready to start that they were talking, but you don't get that access in other sports to the competitors and to the athletes. And so I viewed it as something very positive. Very seldom, I think maybe there was one time that I was a little bit agitated with something that had happened. And so it wasn't the best time to talk to me. I was probably a little bit short. I did answer the question, but I wasn't real happy about having to talk at that very moment. You know, one out of ever how many times was pretty good to make that happen. And, you know, you brought up Mark Martin there. He was somebody that I left out of that group earlier, and I shouldn't have because Mark is a tremendous friend to me. Always has been, and someone that I do stay in touch with on a regular basis. And someone that I consider one of the best race drivers, most fair race drivers, and one of the best people I've ever known in my life in the sport.
I will certainly make sure that I put that in the interview. And just for the record, he also did say that he was one of the drivers that you were one of the drivers he looked up to and still considered a friend. So it's really cool to hear like how close this driver community was back then. And I think as a person that's been following the sport for so long, I think that's why I was so connected with NASCAR and still am today. So that's so cool to know that you guys are all real close to this day. Just got a couple more questions before I wrap it up. I want to keep going, but I know we both have to get going soon. Oh man, this is too fun. Landon Castle, your NBC broadcasting colleague at times, he wanted me to ask you, how was it like to make that transition from the 21 team to Joe Gibbs Racing after 1981 to 92? You know, especially given that JGR was just building itself as a juggernaut team that it's known by today.
That is such a great question. You know, because many people thought that maybe I wasn't making a very sound decision there. It started, you know, they really questioned after I won the August race at Michigan. But I had the decision had already been made by that time that I was leaving. And but there's a lot that went into that decision. But to, you know, to the outside and people looking in, including my dad, a little bit of the time as I discussed this with him. Couldn't exactly figure out why I wanted to leave an organization that had brought me in, basically given me a second chance at my career at the Wood Brothers. Why I'd want to leave them to go race for a football player, a football coach that had never been in the racing business in his life. And you have to know Joe Gibbs. He's very persuasive. And the thing that I looked at and kept telling my dad and my wife, Kelly, was that Joe Gibbs is a winner. He's a winner at life, and he understands people. He understands that you win with people. And that's why I decided to take that chance. He had a relationship with Rick Hendrick. I knew we'd be getting good cars. I looked at this, and I literally told my wife, I said, I'm doing this. This is my chance. I believe with the Hendrick Motorsports, with the Chevrolets at the time, I said, this is my chance to win the Daytona 500. And did I know it was going to happen in the second year that we were together? No, I surely didn't. But there was just something that was telling me that. And, you know, conversely, when I decided to leave Joe Gibbs Racing, a lot of people questioned me about that and going to Robert Yates for what at the time was only a one-year deal. So I made some tough decisions along the way. But my faith got me through that. I prayed a lot about it. And those were the answers that I came away with. And I felt like I was being led in the right direction with that. And that transition to a brand new team, gosh, there were so many things that came with that. My brother-in-law, Jimmy Makar, was who I wanted as a crew chief. And he was brought on in that capacity. He ran the team, is still there today, as one of the, he's in charge of all the racing operations at Joe Gibbs Racing. And, but there were challenges. I mean, we literally, you know, the Wood Brothers were a small organization, but we only had 18 people at Joe Gibbs Racing that first year. And, so there were a lot of challenges that we faced. You know, we had no points to get in races on at the beginning. So the pressures of qualifying were amplified. Even when we went to Indianapolis in 1994 because of where we were in the points for the first time, I had to qualify on time to make that race. So there were a lot of challenges, but that Joe Gibbs changed my life in a lot of ways. And, you know, certainly it was great of the opportunity that he gave me, but personally, Joe Gibbs changed my life. And I'm forever grateful and thankful that I took that challenge and went to help him build that race team that is one of the top, if not the top, organization in the sport today.
I mean, that's so cool that you basically were the pioneer of what has become this most dominant organization that I think since 1992, I think a lot of competitors still look up to you and try to measure themselves up to. And I think that they, you know, folks today should credit you and look to you and your brother-in-law, Jimmy Makar, for, you know, building that empire. And I think that is just incredible to know that you never, if taking that chance, that leap of faith would just evolve so many people's lives. I think that's just incredible. Yeah, I mean, that's just, I can't even imagine just making that decision because of, you know, you're in a good situation with the 21 team, then go to the 18, and you were able to, you know, build such great experiences, successes. So that's incredible as it is. I would love to talk more at some point about this if possible, just because
yep,
I feel
sure.
It should be a part two to this whole situation, but. My last question for you before I wrap things up for this project with you, is knowing that, you know, obviously most people know you for the 1999 Cup Championship. You've got the 3 Daytona 500 wins. You've got the 2 Brickyard 400 wins. But for you, what is the most proudest achievement you've had in NASCAR?
I would have to say that my proudest moment was winning the championship in 1999. you know, I think that I couple that with the fact that I feel like that I made a difference in the sport, that I left the sport when I retired from driving, and obviously I'm still very involved in the sport. But from a competitor standpoint, you want to make a difference. And I feel like that I did that. There were things that I did that enhanced the popularity of the sport. It gave people Sundays and Saturday nights to give them a reason to turn on their TV. I had incredible relationships with some of the biggest companies in the world, with Ford Motor Company, with Coca-Cola, and I could go down the list. But just the opportunity to represent those companies. But from a professional standpoint, the feeling of accomplishment of winning a championship, and being the best for an entire year, there was nothing like that. I mean, the induction into the Hall of Fame, that's a whole nother level, a whole nother thing. When that happened in 2014, that was just, that was beyond anything that I could ever fathom in my life. But when, you know, when I started racing, and even whenever I retired from driving, you know, there wasn't a Hall of Fame. So that wasn't something that I was looking at. I just wanted to be the very best that I could be. So my biggest accomplishment, was winning that championship and giving Robert Yates, his one and only championship as an owner.
And that was Dale Jarrett, who is, of course, of now NBC on NASCAR, and of course, former driver of the number 88 car from Robert Yates Racing. So my thanks to Dale Jarrett, and of course, the Ford Performance, with Dan Zacharias in particular, with making that interview possible back in 2020. I'm so happy we could do this in 2023 with the 75th anniversary season, and hope to catch up with you, Dale. It would be fun to talk shop with you about the latest happenings in NASCAR and more stories about your good old days in the Cup Series. With that, folks, we're almost wrapping up our show. So much to look forward to, folks. I mean, there's lots of news going on. Final thoughts. I mean, as of this evening, as we're recording on Wednesday night, Trackhouse Racing left a cryptic tweet or X post, if you will, saying 8:01 p.m. So who knows what that is? I'm sure Nathan and I will talk more about that on next week's show. So Nathan, what do you think are your final thoughts on this week's program?
So obviously a lot of speculation on what that could be. Don't know if that's any sort of silly season news or what, but you know, obviously mentioning the silly season picture, we didn't mention it, but Matt DiBenedetto and Rackley War, they're parting ways, so that came out today as well. So interesting to see where Matt will end up. Who knows if that's connected or not. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but obviously you all will know by the time this comes out. But just looking forward to the playoffs. I mean, I love the playoffs. I mean, there's obviously intensity every single week. Xfinity regular season's winding down. We only got two races to go there, which is hard to believe too. That's, you know, they've been putting on a show nearly every week, and I think them ending the regular season with Darlington and Kansas is going to be a ton of fun, and then opening up the playoffs at Bristol instead of wrapping things up. But looking forward to it. Darlington's always one of the best weekends of the year, so hopefully they'll put on a good show. And obviously, of course, stay tuned to the website.
Yes, indeed, folks. We've got a lot of coverage coming your way, so lots of fun and games to be watching on the world of NASCAR and, of course, IndyCar and everything else in between in motorsports. Well, with that, folks, I think it's time to put a bow on episode number 84. So for Nathan Solomon and Dale Jarrett, this is your host, Rob Tiamison, saying thanks so much for tuning in to TPF Live, the world's fastest hour of racing talk. Check out our previous episodes on major podcasting platforms. And stay tuned for episode number 86 of TPF Live, which is the post-Darlington, pre-Kansas edition of our show. We're going to go to the Midwest after being basically in the East Coast for a lot of this summertime season. So lots to look forward to with that. But until next time, folks, let's all go get that checkered flag. And as I always like to say on our show, so long, everyone.